joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. The time is now 8 a.m. Up next is Thursday Morning Talk Radio with Linda Olson Osterlin after these short messages.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
KBOO is hiring. We're currently accepting applications for our Volunteer and Outreach Coordinator position. We're looking for someone with experience in volunteer management and outreach to diverse communities and preferably has experience with nonprofits. This is a full-time position. For the full job description and instructions on how to apply, see the job listing on our website at kboo.fm/employment. Applications are due Saturday, March 22nd by 5 p.m. KBOO is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer.
Come join in the conversation with ML Lori on our new podcast, What the Hell is Going On? A conversation about our human experience, our human condition, and the obstacles that we all have to happiness. This podcast is an extension of the segment Let's Stop for a Minute that ML produced for the KBOO radio show, The Politics of Living. So go to kboo.fm/what the hell is going on, or you can go to www.kboo.fm, audio, podcast, and what the hell is going on.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Live Your Dreams Party, Saturday, March 7th from 6 to 9 p.m. at Wayfinding Academy in Portland. Live Your Dreams Party is Wayfinding Academy's annual fundraiser. This year's theme is comfort. This event will provide a welcoming environment to kick back, relax, try something new, and learn more about the Academy's mission. Again, that's Live Your Dreams Party, Saturday, March 7th from 6 to 9 p.m. at Wayfinding Academy, 8010 North Charleston Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio this morning. You are tuned into More Talk, not More Talk Radio. I guess we're calling it Thursday Talk Radio now. We've been playing with the titles a little bit as we change up our morning line of callers and talk shows. And so this is Thursday Morning Talk Radio, and I'm your host, Linda Olson Osterlin, and I'm very happy to have two guests with me in the studio today. My first guest is Joanna Ogden. She's an independent historian. She has written two really important historical pieces that are in the Oregon Historical Quarterly, and we'll be talking about one of those, which is about the St. John riots. St. John's 1910 Riot and Rebel. And so that's our topic today. Now, you hear me say St. John's Riot. Does she mean St. John's? Yeah, I mean St. John's right up there in North Portland. It was an independent city, and there was a riot against Hindus living in the area. And then you might also say Hindus, because most of us didn't know that there were Hindus living in our area in the early 1900s. But there were, and that's also something Johanna Ogden, as an independent historian, dug up and did an important article for in the 2012 summer edition of the Oregon Historical Quarterly. And so we're really glad to have you. Welcome, Joanne.
Thanks for having me.
Joanne, I'm going to call her Jo. I've known her, I'll be honest, full disclosure, I've known her since 1973 or something, way down in Corvallis. So we've known each other a very long time. And she was not a historian at the time that I know about, and I was not a radio producer at the time. But here we are, and I'm really glad to have her in the studio with me. We also have Navneet Kaur. Now, I interviewed Navneet before, and some of you may remember it. It was about the men from India who were locked in the Sheridan prison by ICE and who were being held in very wrong conditions for their situation. And actually, it's not even legal to hold them in a federal prison. She was one of the community members who took action to support those people who were really quite distraught and not being able to practice their normal religious practices or cultural practices. And she and other members of the Sikh community throughout Salem and around the valley came together and gave a lot of support to those people. She's also a member of the committee for the commemoration of the St. John's 1910 riot. So welcome, Navneet.
Thank
Very
you.
Nice to have you
Good
here.
Good morning.
And nice to meet you again. Was phone before.
Absolutely.
All right. So what are we talking about, this St. John's riot, a race riot? In St. John's, you know, when I was growing up, I heard about race riots, but they were always the ones where it was people of color who were rising up in the rioting situation. There was the White Watts riot, big one. The United States government sent tanks against our own people in California. I believe it was 1965. But there were other things like that. I had never... History was stolen from me because there had been many other what were called, even in those times, race riots, but that was whites and often predominant members of white communities who were driving out people who were of different ethnicities or races or different colors in forwarding the ends of white supremacy. So I know now that Tulsa had a major race riot. My mother was born in Tulsa a few years after that. I never heard about that riot. We did talk a lot about the issues of race. She did support civil rights and, you know, liberty and freedom for everyone, but I never heard about that riot. So I'm so excited that we can bring a portion of Portland's history to us now. Now it sounds like, I'm so excited we had our own riot. I'm really not excited we had our own riot. What I'm excited about is that we can know about it. And maybe we want to start there with Johanna or Navneet about how important it is to learn history that's been lost to us.
So I want to, I want to address that question. I want to back up. Yeah. I'm Jo. I want to back up and just talk about language for a second, because this was termed an anti-Hindu riot. And I think we have to put that word in historical context. And I think it's all the more important to do that given the headlines out of Delhi right now and broadly in India. By Hindu, what was meant then in its best use meant the geographic location of Hindustan, which is what we understand to be is modern-day India and Pakistan. At its worst, it was a racial slur. It meant anybody from, again, what we now know as India and Pakistan, and mainly the people that were here in Oregon in the early 1900s were Sikhs. There were also some Muslims and Hindus, but it was predominantly a Sikh community. And so we're going to use the word Indian, and that gets confusing in an American context because of indigenous peoples and the sovereign rights thereof. But that's what we're talking about when we're talking about Hindus.
And when we talk about riots, there are other language used for attacks against people, marginalized peoples around the world. Do you want to say, like, what's the difference between a pogrom and what happened in St. John's? A pogrom is when it's organized to go in and sweep into a community and destroy it and take off the wealth and drive the people out or put them in jail.
So, you know, I think, you know, I've just been reading about this, and I think Navneet can speak to it more powerfully than I can about India, where people are talking about riots versus pogroms versus ethnic cleansing. And I think one of the key distinctions that I've been reading about and that I think applies to St. John's is that the state is aiding and abetting the violence. That's what we're talking about here, and that's exactly what happened in St. John's in 1910. I don't know if you want to weigh in on that too.
No, I totally agree with you. You're right on point. I want to speak very cautiously about this issue, but I want to put this across that I think that it's India has a really, like, if you delve back in history, you will see these pogroms, as we call them, repeated over the time. And I just personally, I was talking to Johanna yesterday, that I personally believe that, yes, the state is abetting it and aiding and abetting in that. And I think, yes, the state is, you know, just like laying dormant, you know, the police force, and they have their specific orders not to respond in cases of violence breakouts, and even when they get like people calls or even people running into, so not to respond. And I just strongly believe that this is just a political card. They play the race card or the faith card to do this. It's just really not a neighbor killing other neighbor. I don't see it like that.
It's like forces out of control that are being allowed.
Mobs
out of control.
Yeah.
And there's a political program behind it.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to say here that the committee that Navneet and I are working with, the St. John's 1910 Riot and Rebels Committee, and there's a Facebook event page, everyone, St.
Yes,
John's 1910, please look it up, and we're having an event on March 21st, is that while all of us have opinions about what's going on in India and think it's, you know, very important to be aware of and follow, is the unity for this event is what happened in St. John's in 1910. And personally,
you'll segue into telling us about what happened in 1910.
Right. And basically, on the night of March 21st, 1910, so our event is literally on the day, at the anniversary of the day that it happened. So on the night of March 21st, 1910, basically there was a small sort of face-off in the local bar, Condon Saloon, spilled out into the streets, and there was lack of a better term, a mob of 200 quickly gathered. And this had been brewing for a while, and I can come back to that. But basically, the mob gathered. They went to down the street from the saloon. We're talking right in downtown St. John's. The saloon is where we're going to gather that day, where it used to be. They went to where Indians were living above businesses, you know, and one of those, they threw a man out of the second story window. They robbed people at gunpoint. They went down the hill towards the St. John's Lumber Company, which is down basically at the base where the bridge is now. Went through people's homes there, ransacked them, robbed, stole from them pretty much all their money and belongings. Went into the mill, gave them the edict that they had to leave work immediately. They were shoving people onto the streetcars and saying, don't ever come back to St. John's. And
were these all men that were being attacked because women had not come to, women had not been brought into marriage and stuff here?
It was the Indian community was, you know, there's, to my knowledge, one woman and two children that were female children in the state of Oregon. It was a male community for a lot of reasons. But basically, the point of this riot was to drive Indians out of the town of St. John's. And there were probably 150, maybe 200 living and working in the area of St. John's. There was another community right across the river in Linton also working in the mill there. And these were mill workers at St. John's Lumber and at Monarch, which was at the north and sort of east end of town. And
those places we can find still.
Yeah, and we're going to do a walking tour of a lot of these sites that were a part of the riot. And part of my, I guess my goal as a historian is that when we look at the places that we live in, we think about it differently, about who was here, what kind of history transpired. And I think that's part of the point about doing a walking tour is we need to know this history. We need to know who lived amongst us. And I want to emphasize this is not history for Indians. This is all of our history. And it gets a lot at the question of who we are today and highlights some important questions today.
Yes, well, thank you very much for that, Joe. I think really one of the points I like the best was the last one you made is this is our history. This is the town that I've lived in most of my life. This is the town I call my hometown. And sometimes I'm deeply ashamed of it, and sometimes I'm very proud of it. And, you know, that's the way it is with our towns, isn't it? But I think it's important for us to know our history, or we can't understand what's come forward. I know that when I first moved to Portland, and I had lived here as a child but moved in other parts of Oregon, came back as an adult in 75, end of 75, in early 76, that I right away heard from realtors in the St. John's area that there was a red line and only white people were allowed in St. John's. Only white people were allowed from the line on Interstate Avenue was the line, and only white people were allowed to go west of that line. And, you know, we told them we were disappointed. We wanted to have, you know, people of color and other people around us. We thought we were being in North Portland that we would accomplish that. He was very clear that that wasn't going to happen here. And so I wonder, when I think about the history of then in 1910 and we go to 1975, what, only 65 years. And I know when I've worked inside or you know, worked out at Matt Dish and Jim and been around a lot of African-American people here, St. John's has had a reputation. I mean, it's just one of the areas where, you know, if you mention it, there's a look, there's a knowledge, there's a worry. I don't know if that's fair at all about current St. John's, so forgive me, I'm not saying anything about current St. John's in terms of that, except that the history comes with it. It comes forward. I do want to, before we say much more, I do want to let the audience know this is your call-in opportunity. I promise we won't talk a whole time and not let you call. I'm betting you have all sorts of questions about what happened, how did it happen, and what's this commemoration going to be? So please feel free to call and get all the information you want or make comments or bring forth your own knowledge and thoughts about white supremacy. The whole reason the Oregon Historical Quarterly did a whole issue on white supremacy and resistance is to keep that history coming forward for our knowledge and for the conversation to be carried forward right now. So the number to call is 503-231-8187. Let me do it again in case you're a little bit sleepy. 503-231-8187. I personally tend to listen to these talk shows as I'm waking up laying in my bed, so you're allowed to call even in that way. So let's go a little bit more. Nandit, why don't you talk a little bit more about what the Gadar people being here, living here in this society, and then later the riot meant. They didn't leave right after the riot, though. That didn't succeed in driving everybody out
by
any means.
They were pretty persistent.
That's a strength.
Yeah. So I think that, and I don't know if many of us know that the situation in India at that time, it was being ruled by the British, and any sort of struggle of independence was seen as being a traitor, you know, yeah. And as being disloyal to the country, and you could be thrown in prison for years and years to come. So I think these guys were just, And Joe can talk, you can intervene whenever you think, because I'm not so aware of the history, but as far as I know, that the Gadar actually didn't just happen overnight. It was like a process, like it was brewing in there, of course, but it came to the surface after a long row. Mm. So these guys left India, to my knowledge, not maybe just for this one focus. I think they were seeking better life for themselves. They were seeking, and people who were in the West, they saw that people could live more independently, have their own lives the way they want. Everyone wants to live that way. So I think the reason that they migrated initially to United States and Canada,
And they weren't part of the Exclusion Act, the Exclusion Act that tried to exclude Chinese. That was a little bit later.
No, I mean, the thing about the Chinese Exclusion Act that came in around 1882 is that it was renewed every 10 years or something like that, which was then cause for sort of kicking up all that BS about sort of the attitudes behind that. And there were constant calls to expand it to include other groups. That never officially happened, but I think there's an important difference between what's officially the law and what's actually the law. And there's no question that the U.S. was formed by, you know, is a white settler society. And
okay. Yeah. So it was a settler society, and wasn't part of. Just want to get this part. Wasn't part of them coming to Oregon in that the violent riots that had been held in California. I know that there was a Chinese community in Eureka that was driven out, and that still lives in the memories of people who live around Eureka as well.
So, and I think Navneet's point about. Is really important about sort of the global context of this. And I don't think any of the events in St. John's are understandable unless you look at it from the global event about both why people came here, why the riot happened, and the response, especially from Indians, in terms of deciding not just to fight in an American context for more rights and inclusion, but to overthrow British colonialism. And it was basically what people were realizing is it didn't matter where they were followed by a status, and that was a second-class status at best. So that's, I think that whole context is really important. So your point about the violence, it had a lot to do with why Indians settled in Oregon. It wasn't just, but it was closer even than the anti-Chinese violence that plagued the entire West in the late 1800s. In 1907, there was a wave of violence against Asian people, and I'm using that term cautiously as a term of convenience, but by that I mean against Chinese, Japanese, and that those riots happened from the border, the California-Mexico border, all the way up to British Columbia in 1907. In Bellingham, Washington in 1907, it was specifically directed at expelling 200 Indians who lived and worked in Bellingham. And that was the culmination of a Labor Day celebration that happened in that town. People left, the Indians left, many of them crossed over the border back into British Columbia because they'd been promised that they were equal, they had equal status under the British Crown. About a few days later, another riot broke out in 1907 in Vancouver, British Columbia that involved 10,000 people, so one of the largest in British Columbian history. And both in St. John's and also in these other riots, I really want to emphasize this is not just laborers. There were many, many laborers involved, but it's also prominent citizens. You know, in the case of St. John's, it was the mayor, it was the police chief, it was the St. John's newspaper reporter, and I think there's sort of a knee-jerk reaction here that it's only laborers doing this. And I think we need to break that down a little bit more, that it's a question of all strata of society and the role of white supremacy plays in that.
And the role the ruling parties played within it. Mm-hmm. Well, I believe we have a couple callers. I'd like to get John on the line.
Hello.
Good morning, John. Thanks for calling.
Well, if anybody has any time, if they go through eastern Oregon, especially this one town, Pendleton, where I'm from, they have this thing called underground tours. And it, you know, like Pendleton at around that time was called the Las Vegas of the Pacific Northwest because it was right in the center of the Pacific Northwest. And they had a lot of Chinese laborers over kind of, what do you call it, overflow from the Union Pacific Railroad that was built. And they used a lot of, you know, Chinese from the West, Germans and Irish from the East, you know. So, but during this tour, you would go into in these really, oh God, it was underground, but it was even underground with the basements, where you could see where these, well, like cooks and stuff, where people had hammocks, and this is where the Chinese would go, and that's their quarters, and you would see the walls and the ceilings kind of burnt, and that was from all the opium smoking that was going on. But what I'm getting to, they had sundown laws in Pilsen, and if anybody that wasn't white that was out, they were fair game, really, to murder them. And also in this town, they had exclusion laws. Pilsen's a hilly town, and the north side of the town, was, even up to when I was in high school, no minorities were allowed to, you know, to reside there.
What I lived in Pendleton as a child as well, John, and I'm curious that you say that because I was aware that we very rarely saw any people of color in the schools, in the public schools. And that was explained to me that all the Native American people were going to the Catholic schools. I don't know if that was true, but that was the way it was explained to me.
No, that wasn't true. No.
But when you were young, did you know about? Did you know that there was that real estate line in that town too that you could?
Only when I got into my teens.
Uh huh.
And just then, you know, talking to different peoples and stuff. But
so the red lines went even to small towns, because when you say Pendleton was the Las Vegas of the West, you have to start laughing pretty much, because it's a very, very small town compared to any of the cities, even in Washington. But did you, I want to ask, what was the effect of seeing those tunnels on you? How did that impact you, seeing the physicality of real history?
I already knew that Pendleton was, you know, it's a cowboy town, so it's already, you know, stereotype is, you know, super redneck. But the town at the time when I was taking this tour, I was always wondering why the top levels of all downtown were all empty and kind of gutted. And they were all brothels. There were 32 saloons and 16 brothels in a four-block area.
Whoa!
Yeah, the tour guide, I mean, it was
more than churches.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Portland had on the west.
That's
side
okay.
Of,
that's okay. Keep on with Pendleton.
Okay, but anyway, but I'm just trying to say that was, you know, anybody that was, they had really sundown laws, and Chinese were only allowed to come out in the daytime. That's what they were saying.
Yeah. So thank you for bringing that up, John.
Yeah, and you know, they even had a Chinese cemetery. You know, everything was pretty much, it was kind of interesting. But
yes.
I'm just kind of making that whole thing that even in the small towns, whether it be gold miner or railroads or mining, you know, they had a lot of minorities there, but they were really isolated, one little small group. And if they went out of that area, they were either beaten up or killed. That's all I'm trying to say.
So I appreciate you calling in and talking about this, and I'm no expert, but I do know that there's some controversy about those underground tours in Pendleton, so that might be worth checking in on.
I understand, but, you know, I was really kind of shocked because I lived there, you know, and just saying, wow.
But your point is well taken, I think, in terms of, you know, the history of sundowner laws and those kinds of things in various parts of Oregon. But relating it back to St. John's is one of the things as a researcher that I've come to appreciate is that white supremacy doesn't just work in one way across all places and all times. It shapeshifts across time and place. And I think those particularities are super important. And in the greater Portland area, actually the St. John's, the people that rioted were put on trial. There were 190 warrants issued the day after the riot, and it was largely because Indians had gone to the British consulate, gone to the Multnomah County authorities, the prosecutor, and they were back the next day pointing out their accusers.
That was so brave. I read that in your story. I'm going to interrupt. I just want to say how brave it was of these men to go get the authorities and say, come with me, I'll show you the men that beat me up.
That's why I said they were pretty persistent.
Yes.
Yes.
And I think it was they had already been through, I mentioned all the violence in 1907. They were in no mood to sort of go through that again. But I also think you have to ask, in all that violence in 1907, there were absolutely no prosecutions in anywhere. The only one was in Boring, Oregon, and that's a whole nother story I'm going to leave aside. But I think it speaks to that there was a very specific form of racial supremacy in the policy for the Portland environs. And it was pursued by very powerful men like Harvey Scott, who is the editor of the Oregonian. It was Matthew Dady, who was one of the writers of the terrible Oregon Constitution when it comes to white supremacy. And basically what that policy was that we're going to oppose, they realized that Chinese driven out from other states were coming to Oregon to flee the violence. And if they opposed racial violence, it would guarantee a workforce that the area needed to build up Portland and its area. So it was a white supremacist policy, but it was one that did not condone overt ethnic violence. And that, I think, is ultimately what's behind the fact that the perpetrators of the riot in St. John's were prosecuted.
Yes, and they did, and the testimony was given, and it was heard in court. So this didn't end in a day of fame with everyone slinking out the next day and having to, you know, run with what goods they could take with them to get somewhere safe. This was the people's day. And I think in that way, not having women and children who had emigrated with them was a benefit. It's always easier to get away if you're not trying to pick up a child and not concerned about someone who might not be able to run. Elderly families have a lot harder time. And I think sometimes, you know, you can be distracted protecting children and get killed yourself. So in a way, I think it was great that they were here. I think it's also pretty obvious that sometimes of people in this sort of massive way, and I'm not thinking, oh, they're thinking politically. They're deciding their future. They're moving it forward. These men who were here, we have another man on the line. Let's get to him. John, I know you're on the line. I'm going to get you on right now. But I want to hear a little bit more about the men who were here and what type of people they were. And is John still there? Oh, we lost him. John, forgive me. Let me do a little announcement here for the rest of our audience. This is Linda Olson-Osterlin with Thursday Morning Talk Radio, and I have as my guest Johanna Ogden. She's an independent historian, and we're talking about St. John's riot, the St. John's 1910 riot and rebel. There's a commemoration of riots that actually took place here in Portland March 21st, and we're talking about that. And I have here with me also Navneet Kaur, and she is sick, I believe, and also a woman who helped the men who were held in Sheraton Prison illegally by ICE and helped work with the lawyers to get them out and to get them taken care of because it was very dire straits just this couple years ago. And so we're going to open the phone lines again, make sure that I promise you I'll get to you faster than I did this last time. So please give us your calls. We do want to hear from you. John, you can call again if you can. It's 503-231-8187. That's the number to call to get in on the conversation. I appreciated John's call because he brought another part of the sort of broken apart history. I had known about a massacre of Chinese along a canyon in eastern Oregon that took place. And many of us had heard of that massacre, but these things are fragmented and not known by the way that history gets written, I guess. By the way that history gets told, we lose whole chunks of it. But can you talk a little bit about the type of men that were here that stood up for themselves that way and what they went on to do? Because I'm so... Okay, well, the second John is still there. We'll let him on, and then we'll get to this other subject. John, you're there.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
All right. Well, I got one question and a quick quote from the Bible, from the New Testament, from Jesus. The question is, where did St. John's get its name, and did Christianity have any relationship to this violence? And then I'll quote my verse.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Oh, you wanted the answer. You want the answer first. Okay.
So John's came from one of the founders of the settlement in St. John's, which was in before 1905, just, you know, even 5-6 years before the riot, was basically an encampment of about 400 people. And I'm talking encampment, tents, you know, mud, all that. And it was the Portland 1905 Lewis and Clark Fair that really jump-started the economy in Portland. It doubled the population, and St. John's was a part of that growth, and both population-wise and industry-wise. That's mainly where most of those industries came from. It was a boom town.
And St. John was named after?
I don't know where the, I don't remember where the St. part comes from, but John's was, you know, the John's Cafe out in St. John's. It refers to one of the early land title people, who a man who held a lot of the land out in St. John's.
Okay.
All right. Well, this has been a very interesting discussion. Well, my quick verse is a paraphrase of Jesus on the cross, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." This is, "Father, forgive me for not forgiving them for being so willfully ignorant."
I'm quite sure that a lot of us could use that one. Thank you very much, John. We appreciate your call. We have another person on the line. Go ahead. I don't have your name.
Can
right
you hear
now.
Me?
Yes. And you are.
Yes,
say your
name.
Go ahead.
My name is Teresa, like Teresa, and I'm calling because I heard a lecture on the Hindus around the, you know, in the early 1900s at a conference in Seattle, and I wish I had more of the details and the dates, but the lecturer talks about the connection with the anti-colonial movement and the buildup of border surveillance that happened at that time, that the Canadian-U.S. border started to be heavily, that surveillance started to be built up, and Secret Service monitoring these activities in the U.S. for the British, in conjunction with the British. So I wanted to ask about that, the riot and that timing, if what the connection was there with the Secret Service, perhaps, in St. John's, with all these government people involved, you know, was there a connection with this kind of international surveillance effort and well, these riots?
Thanks so much for that question. I'm guessing you heard Seema Sohi speak about this, and she's done some brilliant work on it. On this, and if you didn't hear her, I know she has a book out. Mutiny is in the title, and the rest of it's escaping me, but her name is Seema Sohi, and basically, I mentioned the violence in 1907, that the government didn't prosecute, whether in Canada or in the U.S., didn't prosecute the violators. What they did, particularly in Canada, was prosecute the targets. And so they did several things. They basically, the Canadian government moved to stop further migration into Canada of Indians. They actually moved to try to relocate the Indians who were still in British Columbia to try to make go to British Honduras. And then the third thing that they did was they built up a political police surveillance team. And it was led by this guy by the name of Hopkinson, who had been a policeman in India, had migrated to Canada, was multilingual, and he recruited spies, basically. And it was a murderous plot. And I think Seema Sohi's point is that Indians, migrants, and the governmental response to them, both in Canada and the U.S., was a part of building up the border surveillance system that existed between Canada and within those respective countries. And one of the things that I think is interesting about Oregon is that it was relatively, besides this policy of opposing racial violence, that it was kind of out of the loop for a number of reasons of this political intelligence surveillance apparatus that was being wielded against Indians at the time. And one of the and I think that it goes back to the policy about Chinese that existed here and around Portland. It didn't have as big a port. There were many reasons behind that. But it wasn't the same kind of target that California and British Columbia were. So Indians here, not only was it a somewhat less violent place and they had a different kind of relationship with the state apparatus, they weren't the they They weren't under the heat of the political police. And one of the measures of that is that during these trials about the St. John's riots that went on for 2 years, from 1910 through 1912, is...
So it was active in the public's mind for 2 years.
Yes, it was, and it was all
That's
over the newspapers.
Deal.
Yeah, good point. Is one of the men who is the translator for these in these trials was a man by the name of Taraknath Das. Taraknath Das was one of the leading anti-British activists on the West Coast at the time. And you read this and you're just like, who wasn't paying attention here? Who let this guy? It was great. And he helped pen a major article that appeared in the Oregonian about it. But I think the saying about, as much as we talk about white supremacy in the state, it's really important to dig in different conditions in different areas that, it existed everywhere, but the way it played out was different, and that gave people different kinds of openings to organize and live.
If I may add a little bit to my recollection, I think that the later on, the Kamagatamaru incident was also connected with the larger conspiracy between of the British, I should say. I think at that time, when like Canada was also a British colony, and so these guys fled the dire situations. There were over 300, and Joe, just intervene when you think I'm not historically correct. Over 300 people that boarded this ship, rented this ship, which was also a part of, from the Japanese, which was again a part of another larger conspiracy on the part of Japan, which maybe, you know, we shouldn't talk right now. But they rented this ship and they came to the West to live a better life, away from this oppression and the ruling power, British. And they were stranded on the harbor
In Vancouver, BC.
And because Vancouver, BC was mentioned here, so that kind of, you know, yeah, stirred that memory. Most of them, I think besides 20 men, were all sent back only to be attacked at the harbor itself on their arrival by the British, and many killed and incarcerated. And that was also like a larger British and Western or white conspiracy, I should say. Let the dormant be dormant. Let them be our slaves forever, you know.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Teresa. Did that?
Thank you.
Yeah, thank
yes,
you.
Yes, that was great. Thank you.
Thanks
you so
much. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, thank you for the call. And this thing about how it is carried out differently and the different roles of intelligence, you know, we know that there there isn't still a Portland Intelligence Unit. There used to be a Portland Intelligence Unit that we found out in 1982 had been asked to, they had said they destroyed all their records because they were illegal. They were taking records on people in churches and every peace movement and everything possible, and had boxes and boxes of them. And the man who was with intelligence and kept those records died, and those records came into the hands of the Tribune newspaper, and they were able to make them public. And we found that they had been surveilling 150 different organizations in Portland, and I promise you only about 3 or 4 of them sounded dangerous at all. The rest were, you know, like Quakers, literally church organizations, school organizations, activism of all sorts were being surveilled. So it's interesting to hear this surveillance coming out of the forming of these needs for surveillance to watch what happens. To me, it's interesting that the people who came to Oregon, who ended up being here by the time that riot happened, were politicized. They were being politicized by their own experience and their own history. And then also, that was a time when there was, you know, certain kinds of teachings being pandered about, you know, how do you rise up against an oppressive force? What do you do? So it's interesting to me that they almost like had the space here to form their desires and to go back and fight for independence against Britain, high goals. Now, most of the men that were here and went back did not survive, right? They went back to be in a revolution and many of them died.
Joe knows in detail about it, but I know that that it as I said, that the Gurdar was brewing. And as she said, Taraknath Das was one of the very active
Gurdar is the name of the movement. Yeah.
And the Gurdar is the name of the movement. And then joined by Son Singh Pakhna and Kashi Ram and many others, other freedom fighters, I should say. This became a big movement. And I know the first movement, and Son Singh Pakhna and many of them went back, led by Son Singh Pakhna. And I think the first movement did not succeed. And I think Son Singh Pakhna was taken into custody. Joe can speak in detail about that.
Well, let's go to our next caller and we'll get more into detail. I also want to remind people there's going to be a commemoration of this on March 21st, and it's going to be 4 hours, and it's going to be right at the location where the riot started, and you're actually going to get to see that. There'll be other, we'll have Joe and Navneet talk about the rest of what that event, what that commemoration will be, because it sounds really exciting to me. I know a lot of you have probably gone on walking tours of the Black Panther history here in Portland and other tours that we have throughout Portland that bring history alive. Well, this will be an opportunity to see exactly where the events we were talking about took place. Do we have another caller on the line? George, good morning. Thank you for being patient, and thank you for calling in.
Well, this is a very interesting program, and I remembered something, but now I'm wondering, perhaps it does not apply to St. John's or Oregon, but I read in, I think, a history of the steel mills back east, and then I read something like the same thing about World War I, that there were representatives of major corporations sent to Europe to recruit people for steel mills work, and they ended up in some of the giant ones in Pennsylvania. And I think there was something the same done to recruit Chinese people to come and help build the railroads, which came out west. And I don't want to take time on the phone if this is, but I did read that, and I don't want to take time now because we're focusing on Oregon, but I thought it might be of interest to people to know that corporations and perhaps our government had sent recruiters to other parts of the world to get people to come here.
Thank you for bringing that up, George. You know, because up until now, I believe, we still have representatives that go down to Mexico and to other countries to recruit workers for our fields. We here in Oregon have a wonderful agricultural valley and area that we want to protect and sustain, but the workers for it are mostly from out of the country, and many of them come just once a year and go back to Mexico. Others try to make a life here and stay longer, but it's interesting that they've always been doing that. That's the behind the scenes part of it.
Well, this program is bringing so much to light, and I want to thank you. I want to hang up and listen. This is a marvelous program.
Thank you, George. We appreciate that.
So on this point about recruitment, you're absolutely right. Industries did send recruiters out. Cities sent recruiters out to trying to build up their cities, especially in the West. It's like, come populate it. In St. John's, the newspapers were calling on people to write their relatives, like in Missouri, to come out and join them and build up the city because St. John's was going to be the next big thing. And I've read reports that recruiters from Astoria were in India trying to get workers for the mill there, too. This was a time of, you know, we're sort of on the, you know, after the U.S. Civil War, there was a huge industrial expansion, and there was a North America was basically a big sucking sound for workers from all over the world. And this was the ground zero for unprecedented ethnic mixing in the world. And I think that's a really, we're talking about millions upon millions of people landing in the same space, working next to each other, living next to each other. And it had never happened on this scale before.
That's really an interesting point, Joe, because I know that when I'm among a lot of people from different countries, it's very exciting. It's sometimes very scary because I don't know how to talk right. I'm afraid I'll be embarrassed. But it's very exciting. And the thought that these would be people that I forgot, you know, there wasn't planes. People weren't meeting people from India weren't meeting people from China, meeting people from, I mean, some would along the coast, but that would be a whole new phenomena.
So I would like to add a little bit to the reason that I keep saying joke and speak, so more it's the history of India where I come from. And the reason I do not know much about this history is because it's lost. It's not there in the books. Mm-hmm. You do not hear about Oregon. You do not hear about Astoria, Portland, any of these places. And the only people that I know about is Bhagat Singh Thind, Son Singh Pakhna, and I have heard about Kashiram. But all this history is not there in the Indian books, the only Indian history books. The teachers of history do not know about this history. And it's so disheartening and tragic, I think, to me, that we've lost this chunk of history in politics.
Yes, and Navani, that's part of, like, when you, Joe, when you wrote the first article about Hindus living here in Oregon and in Astoria, and when you wrote that, you actually went, you traveled to India because mm-hmm. people wanted to hear about this story and commemorate it there. Can you just say a little bit about that? Because she's talking about that lost history. And
yeah, and I think, you know, whatever country we live in, there's a dominant narrative, you know, and that dominant narrative and who gets to control that has a lot to do with what we know. And I am certainly no historian of India. I have nickel knowledge, just enough to try to keep me out of trouble. But I think part of what is operating there is that, you know, the dominant narrative is Gandhi, mm-hmm. 1947, and that there was nothing that went on before. And I think in this country, you know, when you have a country that was founded as a settler colony based on white supremacy, the question of, there's a pretty direct line between who you include civically and politically and who's included in the historical narrative. And so I think that's, you know, there's a really smart historian who talked about there are two elements to history. There's what happened and there's what we say happened. And it's not a conspiracy. It means that our beliefs intervene. Our beliefs intervene, and they intervene in ways about elevating what matters, forgetting what doesn't matter. And in doing this research, it was so clear because these were known people at the time.
Yeah,
this was not an unknown community. They were known. They were doing business downtown. They had banking relationships. You know, they were part of movements going on. And Linda, you talked about this was the time in 1910. There were liberation movements going on all over the world, in Mexico, in Ireland, in Egypt, and the Chinese were organizing, and Indians were a part of that milieu, just like a part of the, for the example, the Wobblies, the IWW, you know. So this was a time of political, but I think these beliefs have come in and filtered out so much that's so valuable for us. So I was invited to India to talk about this in part because, you know, people are trying to revive this history there and understand it better. And these records in Oregon until they've been digitized, have been really hard for people on the other side of the world to get their hands on, just like it's difficult for me to do a lot of that from over there.
And as a result of your work, has more of the history gotten digitized so it'll be there for going forward? We know it'll go forward in the Oregon Historical Quarterly, the special edition out now called White Supremacy and Resistance. The article that we've been talking about all of this is in that quarterly. So we know it'll carry forward in this written form into history.
So I'm by no means responsible for digitization happening of historical records.
Okay.
You know about it. It's changed dramatically in the last 10 or 15 years. The thing I would like to circle back to real quickly is this is the March 21st event is not just to commemorate a riot. It's to commemorate resistance, because I think one of the key things that there's two key points I want people to walk away from. One is the international dimension of this, and I'll just quickly say the British Consulate and the State Department were intervening on these trials. And secondly, is we're celebrating the resistance of Indians. And there's a pretty direct line out of St. John's to the formation of the Gudther Party in Astoria in 1913. And Navneet keeps talking about people like Sohan Singh Bhakna, Kanshi Ram. These are giants in this movement. They're giants. And they're out of St. John's. We have some amazing heroes that came out of here that need to be celebrated.
Yes. Well, we've got two more callers, and we do want to get to specifically what's going to happen on the day. Barth, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for hosting, and thank you for your guests. This is great stuff.
Yeah.
I'm going to comment on some of the things I've heard, and I may throw in a question at the end, but your guest said that there is no conspiracy about history. Not entirely true. If you control the media, if you control the narrative, if you structure the laws, you know, then voices come forward and voices are repressed. And so, you know, the average Joe isn't doing that, but we see the world as we are, not as the world is. So if all of your surrounding echo chamber of life says that, you know, white is right and et cetera, then that really does correspond to a conspiracy behind the scenes. The rioting, yes, apparently that is a small blip in the roadway of Indian history here, but it's a big blip in Oregon history. Oregon was a mean place for non-white people. The Klan had governors probably in that era, you know, let's roll back
to this subject because we've got one more caller and not much more time.
That's part of your subtext is if the upper echelons of the management of the state of Oregon were racist, if they were Klan backed, then that means that suppression is the point of the day. So there's lots of other
okay.
stuff.
Okay, I think we get what you're saying. Thank you. Yes. Thanks, George.
Good day.
Did you want to respond to that quickly?
I'm sorry if I misspoke or wasn't clear in what I said. I didn't mean that there is no conspiracy ever. I was just trying to make the point that it's not just conspiracy. And I think conspiracy in some ways is easier to deal with than belief systems. And that's what I'm trying to get at, that belief systems filter out history, filter out what we know about the world around us, and we just don't see things because of belief systems. And that's more what I was trying to speak to, but I appreciate the clarification.
Yeah, thank you very much. You know, I know we have another caller on the line, but I do want to hear about the events of March 21st, and we have very few more moments. So it's March 21st. It's the commemoration of the riots and the rebels, and it's going to be held in St. John's. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about it?
It's going to go from 1 to 4 in the main plaza in beautiful downtown St. John's. It'll start probably with a welcoming ceremony, including langar, which Navneet can speak about that. There will be some speeches. It will include people from Bellingham that commemorated that riot up there and Truth and Reconciliation Program. It'll include a number of local speakers. And there'll be music and dance, and there'll be a walking tour.
That sounds like so much fun to me. It really does. Any food?
Yes, langar.
Is langar the food part? Okay, talk now, please.
It's a community meal that the Beaverton Gurdwara and the Vancouver Gurdwara have so graciously agreed to providing some to us. and so there will be food.
That sounds wonderful. Well, I'm really looking forward to it, and I'm really happy that the Oregon Historical Quarterly decided to do this special issue and that others have decided to carry the activities on further. It's about time for us to go, so I'm sorry, last caller, we're not going to get to you today, and I do apologize to that. But I want to thank Navneet Kaur and Johanna Ogden for coming here today and bringing forward this piece of history that we haven't heard much about and we need to hear more about. And I feel really grateful to the Oregon Historical Quarterly. You know, I only used to like them because I wanted to go look up who built what house. I know that sounds funny, but they do that too. Yeah. You can find out who built what house in Portland when you're looking at it. But I've really come to realize the importance of them in helping shape our understanding of Oregon and how we've developed. And also, there is a Facebook page. What's the name on that Facebook page?
St. John's 1910.
St. John's 1910 is the Facebook page to get all the information you need to be able to learn about this and come and attend it. March 21st in downtown St. John's. And I want to thank Asia, who's been our engineer today, and thank all of you who have called in and been patient with our long talking. Goodbye.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of The Art of the Steel, the Peace Sham, and the Struggle for Justice in Palestine, Israel, on Saturday, March 7th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at the Grace Memorial Episcopal Church in Portland. The Art of the Steel is a panel discussion and Q&A session organized by members of the Jewish and Palestinian communities in Portland to discuss the current events and injustices happening in Palestine and Israel today. Again, that's The Art of the Steel, the Peace Sham, and the Struggle for Justice in Palestine, Israel on Saturday, March 7th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at the Grace Memorial Episcopal Church, 1535 Northeast 17th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm at the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Press Watch with Teresa Mitchell.
KBOO at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month's screening is Honeyland on Thursday, March 12th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. Honeyland chronicles a Macedonian woman's journey in strife while cultivating honey using ancient beekeeping traditions. Again, that's Honeyland on Thursday, March 12th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.